This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 243.
This podcast is brought to you by Foley. Proper recovery has to include movement. And Foley's standing desk and collection of active chairs give you the freedom to sit, stand, perch, or lean yourself into a healthy, comfortable position at work. Let me tell you what, folks, I actually bought a Foley standing desk before they became a sponsor of the show, and I was very meticulous about researching which one is the best, and this thing is the bomb. I have the Jarvis standing desk. I really believe it's the best one on the market. I don't know why I waited so long to get a standing desk, because I am loving it. Foley is a perfect mix of modern design and healthy movement. So to get your body moving in your workspace, go to foley.com/MTA. That's Foley, FULLY.com/MTA. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we inspire and empower you to go the distance. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we bring you part two of our Heroes of the Marathon series, stories of people who set records, defied conventional wisdom, and helped shape our sport into what it is today. And in the quick tip segment, we talk about ways to easily carry your phone while running. And of course, you can get expert help, guidance, tips, and in-depth training courses inside the academy. You can learn about membership when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. So Angie, I was just listening to NPR and they talked about the Ernest Hemingway House in Cuba. It's a museum with all of his books and personal effects. And now I'm trying to figure out how I can go run a marathon in Cuba and see the house and other great sites. You don't mind if I go run the Havana Marathon, do you?
You're giving up on Germany, huh?
I'll probably go back to Germany too this year.
Well, maybe one of these years you'll be able to do the Cuba Marathon.
So, Angie, just yesterday I found a lake close to our house. I knew it was there, but I had never made the effort to go drive all the back roads to find it. And come to find out there's a nice 5-mile loop around the lake. So now we have a new place to run.
That's exciting.
Everything's still new, but this is new.
New to us.
How's your training going?
It's going good. I got a 16-mile long run in over the weekend in the freezing cold wind.
You got out there on a miserable day.
It was miserable, but I just had to use the time that I had. And then I did 9 miles yesterday, so hopefully get a 20-miler in this weekend. And I don't know what I'm gearing up for, but...
Well, you're kind of kicking around an idea of maybe doing a marathon in April.
I am. I'm just trying to find a weekend that's going to work with our schedule and figure something out, maybe.
Speaking of which, we have some shout-outs. Here are what your fellow runners are up to, and we hope this can be inspiring to you guys listening.
Yeah, we got a lot of great messages in the academy from people who are taking on challenges and meeting their goals. JJ says, I just finished the Shamrock and Half Marathon in Sacramento. I came away with a new PR of almost 3 minutes with a time of 1 hour and 43 minutes. I started getting really tired the last 3 miles, but I kept pushing and I started a new mantra based on something my awesome MTA coach Stephen told me. I kept saying over and over, 100% is always tough, but I'm tougher.
Yeah, awesome. You know, the last 3 miles are tough, especially if you're trying to give 100%.
Right.
Especially in the marathon. I mean, the last 3 miles of a marathon are miserable. But yeah, if you're pushing hard in the half, those last 3 miles are still miserable. I mean, the times where I've tried to get a PR in the half, I've been almost as wiped out as I feel at the end of a marathon.
Even a 5K when you're going all out. I mean, that's pretty miserable.
It gives you a new appreciation for these elite runners that we're going to talk about today that are just pushing better than my 5K pace for 26.2 miles.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, congrats, JJ, on killing it at the Shamrock Half Marathon in Sacramento.
That's right. Marcy says, I finished my fourth half marathon and had a goal time of sub-2 hours. I'm happy to report I clocked in at 1 hour, 58 minutes, and 32 seconds. I not only met my goal, but got a 5-minute PR. I'm super stoked. Thanks to MTA coach Jen for keeping me going and the UCAN tips. And I must officially be a runner because I may be losing a toenail soon. Ouch. But it was worth it.
Thank you, Marcy. And just to let you know, when you lose your first toenail, what runners have customarily done is to make a necklace out of it and wear that to all important functions.
Right.
Isn't that what we do?
I don't know about you, but
So I want to see that toenail necklace, Marcy. Well, congrats on your fourth half marathon and going sub two. It feels great.
And Marianne says, I ran the New York City half today. What an amazing route. This was my first race after my foot fracture more than a year ago, and it's been quite a challenging journey back to running, which made today's race even more special. I wanted to enjoy the race, run with negative splits, and feel strong, as in being able to speed up in the last miles and pass people rather than being passed. I'm so happy to report I accomplished it all. Thanks to MTA coach Lynn.
All right. I love that, Marianne. And you're right that if you can run conservatively and then go for a negative split, or at least an even split, you'll be passing a lot of people the second half of a race.
That's right. And we had a couple other people run the New York City half. Katie says, I ran my first half marathon today, the New York City half. I'm happy to say I completed it, even with my IT band acting up in the last 2.5 miles. But what a great feeling. Thanks to everyone here for your knowledge in all things running. I only started running seriously in the last 9 months. I'm slow and still learning, but so happy to have you all. What a great community.
Well, welcome to the running world. Great to have you. Also in the academy, Katie, and congrats on running your first half. That's huge.
That's right. And this comes from Karima. She says, I wanted to thank MTA coach Steven for believing in me when I didn't. I ran the New York City half marathon today and was nervous all week. But I received an email from him which pumped me up, and I'm happy to report that I have a 4-minute PR, 2 minutes faster than my A goal, and I time qualified for the New York City marathon next year. Next up, Boston.
Yeah, she actually ran a 1:25 half. That's blazing fast, isn't it?
That's awesome.
And Karima was on the podcast. We talked to her about qualifying for Boston last year and overcoming a big knee injury too. That was episode 230 of the MTA podcast. So yeah, congrats Karima on that epic PR and that wicked fast time.
That's right.
Well, now we want to get into some history of the marathon. We're going to be focusing on women's history and 5 great female runners in this episode. If you haven't caught part 1 of this, go back and listen to episode 242, where we talked about Pheidippides and a lot of history of the Olympic marathon and some runners who have shaped the sport. But I hope you guys are enjoying this history-type episode. There's a lot of fascinating vignettes that come from the history of the marathon, and we're excited to get into the content and share about some great runners and see what inspiration that we can derive from their lives. So let's go ahead and get to that right now.
Well on my way, well on my way.
All right, so we're talking about runners you should know. Angie, we talked about some fellas. Now let's talk about the ladies. Of course, there's so many women that have contributed to our sport. So what can you tell us about the history of the women's marathon?
Yeah, I thought I'd quickly kind of mention some names. Of course, you know, the history of women running marathons is a lot younger than men because for many years it was thought that women weren't capable of running long distance. Actually, in March of 1896, Stamatis Ravithi became the first woman to run a marathon when she covered the proposed Olympic course from Marathon to Athens, Greece.
Just kind of on her own, I guess.
Yeah, so 1896 was kind of the start of what we know as the modern Olympic Games. She decided to do this on her own. At the first modern Olympic marathon in 1896, a woman named Melpomene snuck into the marathon. Race organizers had previously denied her the opportunity to compete, so she warmed up for the race out of sight, and when the starter's gun sounded, she began to run along the side of the course. Eventually, she fell behind the men, but as she continued on, stopping for a glass of water along the way, which shows how women are very smart.
Because the men probably didn't do that.
She started passing runners who dropped out of the race in exhaustion. She arrived at the stadium about 1.5 hours after the winner, Spiridon Louis, won the race, but she was barred from entry into the now empty stadium. So she ran her final lap around the outside of the building, finishing in approximately 4.5 hours.
I had never heard of that lady.
Yeah, and that's cool. I had never really known that history before either. Despite strong resistance, women slipped onto marathon courses for the next 70 plus years before they were officially allowed to run in 1972. Women were allowed to participate in track and field events in everything up to the 800 meters in the 1928 games, but several women collapsed after running the 800 meters, and so officials thought it was too strenuous for women, and they were not allowed to run the 800 meters again until 1960. So they were really limited to the short distance stuff.
Nothing more distressing than seeing women collapse.
I guess so.
So what else can you tell us?
Well, Violet Piercy of Great Britain was the first woman to be officially timed in the marathon when she clocked a time of 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 22 seconds in a British race in 1926. However, largely due to a lack of women's marathon competitions, that time stood as the unofficial world record for 37 years. In 1963, American Mary Lepper ran a time of 3 hours, 37 minutes, and 7 seconds to improve slightly on Piercy's record. So there were really no highly competitive times that were recorded simply because there wasn't any competition for women in the marathon. But in 1971, Adrienne Beams of Australia became the first woman to run a sub-3-hour marathon, smashing that barrier with a time of 2 hours, 46 minutes, and 30 seconds. And of course, in 1972, when the Boston Marathon officially allowed women to run, the first woman was Nina Cusick in 3 hours, 10 minutes, and 26 seconds. She had first unofficially run Boston in 1969, but of course, that didn't count until 1972. And then she went to PR in the marathon 2 hours and 50 minutes, and she also set a 50-mile record. And later in life, she's in her late 70s now, she has finished 80 marathons and beyond in her lifetime, so she's continued to run. In 1973, the first all-women's marathon was held in West Germany. It was a success, and the following year, the Women's International Marathon Championship was held again in West Germany. 40 women from 7 countries competed in the event, and 2 years later even became more popular with more women competing, and so pressure was mounting to have the women's marathon included at the Olympic Games. At the time, there were a couple reasons that they didn't allow the marathon in the Olympic Games. The first one is that experts claim that women's health could be damaged by long-distance running. The theory, of course, was proved false, not only by medical studies, but also by the success that women were having in the 70s in the marathon. The other reason they gave was that the Olympic Charter stated that to be included in the Olympic Games, a woman's sport must be widely participated in at least 25 countries, on at least 2 continents, and at that time, women's marathoning was not popular enough to include.
So a lot of these women mobilized, and they began, through the Women's International Marathon Championships, like organizing races around the world, sounds like.
That's right. And so as women's marathons gained popularity in the 70s, the theory that women's marathoning wasn't popular enough to be an Olympic sport was dramatically disproved. And after a long battle, the committee approved adding the women's marathon to the 1984 Games held in Los Angeles. It's just crazy to think that, you know, it wasn't included until that time. I mean, I was 6 years old.
Yeah, some things take a while. So that's a little overview there of how the marathon has changed when it comes to women participating. Let's talk about some remarkable trailblazers in the sport. Let's start with Roberta Gibb.
Yes, Bobby Gibb was born in the United States in 1942, and she grew up around Boston. She loved to run as a child, saying, quote, "I love the sense of running, one foot in front of the other on this earth. When I run, I feel alive and part of the universe." And she started running longer distances when she met a long-distance runner named William Bingay, which was her first husband. And she went on to study at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, Tufts University, the University of California, and New England School of Law. And her running consisted of a daily 8-mile commute to school, and she wore white leather Red Cross nurse's shoes because there weren't any specific women's running gear at the time. So, you know, think about no women's running gear, you know, no specific shoes, no sports bras, nothing. It was
those shoes don't sound very supportive.
They don't. She trained for 2 years to run Boston, covering 40 miles one day for her long run. On another occasion, she was running on a beach in California, and she accidentally strayed into Mexico and was detained by the U.S. Border Patrol. When she applied to enter the Boston Marathon at age 23, race director Will Clooney informed her that women were not physiologically capable of running marathons, and they couldn't run more than 1.5 miles competitively. So on race day in 1966, she wore her brother's clothes over a black bathing suit and hid in the bushes until about half of the pack of runners had started, and then she jumped into the Boston Marathon. The other male runners and the crowd were very supportive, and the press started to follow her progress as she ran the race. The governor of Massachusetts ended up being at the finish line, and he shook her hand when she finished in 3 hours and 21 minutes and 40 seconds ahead of about 290 men. Her feat would make the front page news the next day, and she went on to run the Boston Marathon again in 1967, which is the same year that Catherine Switzer got an official bib number. In 1996, she was officially recognized as having won the race in 1966, 67, and 68, during a time when women weren't officially allowed to enter. Bobby Gibbs said, I didn't intend to make a feminist statement. I was running against the distance, not the men, and I was measuring myself with my own potential. Around the same time, she was denied a place in medical school, saying that, you know, women weren't serious enough to practice medicine. So she went on to practice law. She studied neuroscience and currently works as an artist creating sculpture and paintings. She has written a memoir called Wind in the Fire, A Personal Journey, and she's been given many honors over the years and is a sought-after speaker.
I thought you were going to say she studied law so she can go back and sue all the bastards.
She should. They're probably not alive anymore. But currently at the age of 73, she continues to run an hour several times each week, and she has one son.
And she had an influence on the next lady we're going to talk about, Catherine Switzer, who we've actually had on the podcast last year.
That's right.
We had a great time talking to Catherine. You guys can still go back and hear that episode.
Yeah, that's 211.
Thanks. Angie's on the ball. Episode 211, MTA Podcast.
So Catherine Switzer was born in 1947 in Germany on a U.S. Army base. Her father was in the military. Her family returned to the United States in 1949. And after she graduated, she attended Lynchburg College and Syracuse University, studying journalism and English literature, earning a master's degree. During her college years, she started running long distance, often with the men's cross-country team. And encouraged by her coach, in 1967, she entered the Boston Marathon as K.V. Switzer, and she was given bib number 261. And she didn't do it to, you know, try to deceive race officials, you know, to pretend that she was a man. She simply liked signing K.V. Switzer. So she started the marathon with the men, and at 2 miles into the race, official Jock Semple tried to physically remove her, but was blocked by her boyfriend at the time and her Syracuse teammates.
There's an iconic photograph of her boyfriend, who was a big guy. Jock Semple has this very scary look on his face trying to go after Catherine, and her boyfriend just body blocks the guy. But interesting, like later, I think Jock and Catherine kind of became friends.
Yeah, he ended up apologizing and kind of said that he's a product of his day, you know. Mm-hmm. His ignorance came naturally, I guess. He was just trying to uphold the rules of the race. So Catherine finished the 67 Boston Marathon in 4 hours and 20 minutes, nearly a full hour after Roberta Gibb. Switzer and many other women runners petitioned the Boston Athletic Association to allow women to participate in the marathon. And it was, of course, in 1972 that women were officially allowed to run Boston, which was, you know, basically the first marathon of the day that they were allowed to run. So, you know, in that regard, Boston was kind of ahead of its time, considering the Olympics didn't get a women's marathon until 84. Catherine says, quote, I knew if I quit, nobody would believe that women had the capability to run 26 plus miles. If I quit, everyone would say it was a publicity stunt. If I quit, it would set women's sports back, way back, instead of forward. If I quit, I'd never run Boston. If I quit, Jock Semple and all those like him would win. My fear and humiliation turned to anger. Catherine went on to win the 1974 New York City Marathon in 3 hours and 7 minutes. And her PR was 2 hours, 51 minutes, and 37 seconds in Boston in 1975. She became a television commentator for marathons. She continued to be active in journalism, and she has written 2 books. And, of course, like Trevor said, she ran the 2017 Boston Marathon to celebrate the 50th anniversary of her historic marathon, and bib number 261 was retired.
And today, pretty much half of all marathoners are women.
That's right.
So the sport looks a lot different today than it did 50 years ago.
Yes, for sure.
And here's a short clip from our 2017 interview with Catherine Switzer. She talks about that history-making moment when the race director, Jock Semple, tried to eject her from the 1967 Boston Marathon.
So take us back to the Boston Marathon in 1967. In the book, you talk about the registration was $3 and it had to be paid in cash. And I think you said there was like 733 runners, maybe?
Yep. And it was considered the biggest race in the world, the most prestigious. And the morning of the race, my coach, Arnie, picked up the bib numbers for our team, where some guys from the cross-country team had come with us, as well as my boyfriend, who was an ex-All-American football player, who only was there because if a girl could do it, he could do it. He'd never train more than a mile. I mean, what a motley crew we were, really. But there were a couple of now coincidences that you couldn't repeat in a million years that came together and coalesced that morning. One was the weather. It was horrific. It was snowing, sleeting, headwind. We were utterly miserable with the snow that came down and completely soaked us and turned into big rainy glops. And so we all had on bulky gray sweatsuits. And so from a distance, I looked like one of the guys. And I was sad about that because I had on a very cute shorts and top that I wanted to show.
Yes.
And I was proud of myself. I wasn't there to prove anything, you know. It was a gift from my coach to be there. I had proved him proud. I was very proud of myself, though. And the guys were wonderful. Okay, so they were very welcoming. And they said, I wish my wife would run or girlfriend would run. And so, we, you know, getting into the starting pen and warming up was absolutely no issue. They weren't going to say, there's a girl, get out of here.
Right.
But if it had been hot weather and I'd been in shorts and t-shirt, maybe the officials would have seen me and had a different tune. As it were, they checked off my bib number like anybody else's and pushed me into the starting pit.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, they were harried. They were frantic where they were running out of time. The race was going to be late because of this weather. Everything was very disorganized. And the gun went off and down the street we went. And there is that, you know, first mile of bliss where you're finally there and you're finally at Mecca, you know, you're at the shrine at last, mm-hmm. after all that hard work. Well, what happened is the official was getting teased on the bus by of other officials and journalists saying, oh, there's a girl in your race. And he jumped off the bus and went after me and attacked me from behind. So he grabbed me and it completely blindsided me. I only heard him coming at the last moment. And he was out of control. I mean, I was scared, witless. And really, and I tried to get away, and he was trying to rip off my bib. And then my coach was screaming, leave her alone. She's okay, I've trained her. But then the big, burly boyfriend, Tom, came running full tilt, as you said, and body checked him. Boom. So he was out of the race. And Arnie said, run like hell. And you're laughing, right?
Right.
You're laughing.
Yeah, I'm sure you were terrified.
It wasn't a victorious moment. It didn't feel that way, probably.
Well, it's because it's hilarious in the retelling, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That the girl is running and being saved by her burly boyfriend. It's a Shakespearean drama, really.
Right.
But I was so scared. I was only 20. I felt like I had messed up something really important, that this was some kind of big deal race that I was totally unwelcome in, and I had screwed up. And but anyway, it was too late. My boyfriend had smacked him, and then a really great thing happened is I got angry, and I thought, well, come on, I've been training really hard for this. I know I can do it, and he's just trying to take me out because I'm a woman,
right.
And I've never really had any kind of discrimination like that before, and I made the determination right there, age 20, that no matter what happened, I was going to finish the race. And that was a huge decision for a girl in her first marathon, because you really want to go home to your mom. You're so humiliated.
And it's hard enough to run your first marathon, you know, even if you are welcomed by everyone and you're not overcoming, you know, that discrimination. So,
and the weather's nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so. Right. Well, and also now the press truck's alongside of me, giving me really a hard time.
Oh, no.
You know, like, what are you trying to prove? You know, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. You know, you're not really going to finish this race. You're not serious, right? You know, you can't do this. Women can't do this. You know, you don't belong here. That kind of stuff. And it, instead of getting cowed by it, it only hardened me. And, I often say I started the Boston Marathon as a girl and I finished the Boston Marathon as a grown woman.
Yes.
Because, you know, when we do run a marathon, we really go through a lifetime of experience anyway. But you also can't stay angry and you get resolution. And so throughout this, I was wondering why this had happened. And then I realized I had to do something about it. So I came to the conclusion it wasn't even his fault, the old official. You know, he was just a product of his time.
Right.
But I had to create opportunities for women because they weren't there because they were afraid, or they'd never had an opportunity to experience anything else. And people had told them all their lives these myths, and they believed them because they didn't have an opportunity to experience anything different, to prove it wrong. So, of course, they weren't going to be running in the Boston Marathon. So I needed to create those opportunities. And by making that decision and having that epiphany in the race, when I finished, I realized, hey, that's my life plan. You know, there it is. Boom, become a better athlete. Prove these guys wrong that you can run. And then go ahead and create these opportunities. I didn't know what it was going to look like. But eventually it resulted in a global series of races in 27 countries, 400 races, and a million women that got the event in the Olympic Games. So, you know, you never should limit your thinking in both your physical abilities or what negative inspiration can help you change things into positives. So that was the greatest conclusion from that race. And I swear to you, I don't think a day passes when I don't thank old Jock Semple for attacking me in the Boston Marathon. So now I had all this empowerment, but also the vision, you know, which was great.
So it's really hard, I would imagine, to measure the impact that Bobby Gibb and Catherine Switzer and their colleagues have had on our sport. Many people who were active in the running community back in the 60s and 70s can remember when it was just primarily men who showed up to run the marathon.
Or pretty much any other race distance.
Yeah. According to a report released by Running USA, in 2016, there were a total of 507,600 finishers of the marathon distance here in the U.S. But among the participants, women made up 44% of marathon finishers in 2016. The 2017 report is not available yet. Now, the half marathon continues to be one of the most popular races here in the U.S., and in 2016, women made up the majority of finishers at about 60%, according to Running USA.
Very cool.
So just to illustrate the way the floodgates were opened by ladies like Catherine Switzer for lots of female runners to get into the sport. Another outstanding lady we want to talk about is Greta Weitz. I still remember hearing the news when she passed away in 2011.
Yes. Yeah, Greta Anderson was born in Norway in 1953, and she showed potential in running early on, setting national junior titles. She ran in the 1972 Olympics in Munich, competing in the 1500 meters, and she also competed in distances up to 5000 meters at many other race championships. She was invited to run the New York City Marathon by race director Fred Lebow in 1978, and in her first marathon, which was that New York City Marathon, she got first place and took 2 minutes off the women's world record. In 1971, she was the first woman to run under 2 hours and 30 minutes, and she went on to win the New York City Marathon 9 times. She also won the Stockholm Marathon and the London Marathon twice, with her personal best of 2 hours, 24 minutes, and 54 seconds coming in 1986.
She's just a winning machine.
She was an amazing runner. She competed at many other different distances on the track, road races, cross country, and she took the silver medal in the first women's Olympic marathon in 1984. Of course, she finished behind Joan Benoit Samuelson.
Who we're going to talk about next.
Yes. She completed her last marathon in New York City in 1992 with her friend Fred Lebow, who was suffering from cancer at the time. Greta helped organize corporate races. She coached, did charity work, and was a popular motivational speaker and the author of several books. She died of cancer in 2011 at the age of 57 and was buried with government honors in Norway and has been recognized in many ways since around the world. And there's a New York Roadrunners race called Greta's Great Gallop 10K in her honor.
So I've read that Greta Weitz has been called the first lady of the marathon, and many credit her career with helping focus the world's attention on women's professional distance running in the marathon. You know, in those days, much like today, elite runners began with shorter distances and then moved up to the marathon, and Greta proved to runners and coaches throughout Europe and all over the world that it was possible to go from 1500 meters to the marathon as a competitive runner. Of course, before Greta's time, 1500 meters was considered too far for women to run,
right?
As you've told us, Angie. But yeah, having her triumph at the New York City Marathon year after year after year just really illustrated that, you know, coaches and athletes can put attention on the women's marathon event. And also, it's really hard to estimate, I would think, Greta's impact on her home country, Norway. We've always had a lot of listeners from Norway, so we appreciate those folks. There's actually a statue of her in front of the Bislett Stadium in Oslo, and she started a 5K race in Oslo that grew to 40,000 runners. In one quote, she said, "My goal has always been to introduce other people to running. They might accomplish something they never thought they could."
Very true.
And another interesting note, Angie, I'm sure you've heard the story that, you know, when she finished the New York City Marathon, which was her first ever marathon, and she happened to win and set a world record, she looked at her husband, and I think I even read she threw her running shoes at her husband and said, "Never again."
So if you have run a marathon before and said never again at some point, you're in good company.
Yeah, we probably all thought that.
Yes.
Okay, next we want to talk about Joan Benoit Samuelson.
Yes, Joan Benoit was born in 1957 in the United States, and she resides in the state of Maine. She began running to help recover from a broken leg that she suffered while slaloming, so running wasn't her first sport. She attended North Carolina State, earning All-American honors with her running, and she won the Boston Marathon in 1979, setting an American and a course record of 2 hours, 35 minutes, and 15 seconds. And despite undergoing Achilles tendon surgery, she won the Boston Marathon again in 1983, this time breaking the world record. In March of 1984, Benoit injured her knee severely during a 20-mile training run, which forced her to undergo arthroscopic knee surgery just 17 days before the United States Olympic Marathon trials, which were scheduled. And of course, this was the first women's marathon Olympic trials.
Yeah.
So, you know, a huge thing. She recovered from the surgery very quickly and showed up at the trials as the woman to beat. And of course, like you said, Trevor, she is best known for winning gold in the first women's Olympic marathon in Los Angeles in 1984 with a time of 2 hours and 24 minutes. And she was age 27 at the time. She took the lead about 3 miles into the marathon and held on strong.
Yeah. I mean, she was like all by herself, I think, by the time she got into the stadium.
For quite some time, actually.
If you go back and watch the video of Joan winning the LA Marathon, the Olympic Marathon in 1984, it'll give you goosebumps. It's great. Have you seen that video, Angie?
I have.
So the race finished in the Olympic Stadium, and it was just like filled to the rafters. And when she enters the stadium, everyone's standing up and cheering. And Joan was at least 1 minute ahead of the second place finisher, Greta Weitz, who we talked about. And just looking at her, she's just running with so much gusto. And she had this white hat. It was sort of a large, kind of awkwardly fitting hat. But as she's rounding the final turn around the track, she took it off and began to wave to the crowd. And people just go nuts. And then she finished, of course, and everyone's cheering. And then she took a victory lap, and someone handed her an American flag, and she's running with the flag. And it doesn't even look like she just ran 26.2 miles. I mean, she's like sprinting her victory lap.
The power of adrenaline.
There it is. She's about to go into the tunnel. Now, the people in the Coliseum, most of them know what's going on because part of this race has been up on that big television screen, so they have been watching it. They certainly know what the situation is, and I'm sure they are right now anticipating the imminent arrival of Joan Benoit as she gets into some welcome shade and then very shortly out into the sunlight once again.
What a moment for Joni and the thousands who are in the stadium. It's doubly chilling for many of the people in that stadium.
She has done it. Joan Benoit, the winner of the first ever Olympic women's marathon. Greta Weitz will finish second.
So I can imagine, you know, as the whole world is watching this, and this being the first ever women's Olympic marathon, and this woman looks so fresh after running it, I'm sure it just really convinced people who were not convinced yet that women have what it takes to run a marathon.
Yeah, she didn't collapse and her uterus was still intact.
She's just run 26 miles, 385 yards. She's going to run another 400 meters.
In 1985, Joan Benoit won the Chicago Marathon with an American record time of 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 21 seconds, which is her current personal record. A decade later, in 1998, Samuelson founded the TD Bank 10K as a way to give back to the sport, which has given her so much, and to benefit children's charity. In 2010, she ran 2 hours and 47 minutes for 43rd place at the Chicago Marathon, which was the site of her American record a quarter century earlier, and she recorded the fastest ever performance by a woman over age 52. She says, quote, "For me, running is now about storytelling. As long as I'm passionate about the sport and as long as I'm capable of running, I'll stay with it." She and her husband have 2 children, and she continues to work as a coach, a motivational speaker, and a sports commentator. And now at the age of 60, she wants to be the first woman in her 60s to run sub 3 hours in the marathon.
Yeah, so at the time of this recording, that is the goal that she is training toward. And as a side note, we'd love to have her on the podcast. Just never been able to arrange it.
Yes, it would be amazing.
So if anybody has any connections, give a good word on our behalf. You know, when you mentioned that she ran 2:21:21, I'm thinking like that's got to be to this day the American record. So I looked it up, and actually it's close, but the American record is held by Dina Castor at 2:19:36. Well, we have one more amazing runner to talk about. Paula Radcliffe from England. She right now is the current world record holder for the fastest time in the marathon. Very talented runner. So we're going to talk about her next. But before we do that, we'd like to thank our episode sponsors who make it possible for us to do what we do. Big thanks to Molecule for sponsoring the podcast. Imagine if your phone was the same as it was in the 1940s. Well, that's exactly when the technology you were using to clean your air was developed, with the invention of the HEPA filter. But thankfully, Molecule has introduced a breakthrough science that is finally capable of destroying air pollutants at the molecular level.
Molecule's PECO technology goes beyond HEPA filtration. It captures and completely destroys the full spectrum of indoor air pollutants, including those 1,000 times smaller than what a HEPA filter can catch. In fact, in a study of 49 allergy sufferers presented at the American College of Asthma, Allergy, and Immunology, Molecule's technology provided dramatic, statistically significant symptom reduction within a week of use. One customer even said she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. And for many people, as the spring rolls around, their allergy symptoms increase, so this will be a great time to think about your indoor air quality.
So for $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com, that's M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com, and enter the code MTA at checkout. Molecule, the air you were meant to breathe is finally here. We'd also like to thank RX Bar for sponsoring this episode. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar made with a few simple, clean ingredients, which all serve a purpose. And in the interest of full transparency, all of the core ingredients are labeled right on the front of the package, so there is absolutely no BS.
That's right. I always carry one in my purse. Actually, right after yoga class today, I had the coconut chocolate one, which is delicious.
I would do yoga just for that.
So they're perfect to have as a snack on the go to keep you from getting something less healthy. And they're definitely have a great amount of protein in them and very tasty as well. There is 11 delicious flavor varieties, all of which are gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and free of any added sugars, artificial flavors, or preservatives, or colors, or fillers. You can actually taste the cocoa, the real fruit, and the spices.
So for 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/MTA and enter the promo code MTA at checkout. That's rxbar.com/MTA and use the code MTA for 25% off your first order. We also like to thank our friends at Health IQ for sponsoring this episode. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for runners. Just like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle.
That's right. You can qualify by taking one of their health quizzes or by submitting a screenshot from a race result. So if you've just completed the LA Marathon, for example, or the New York City Half Marathon, you can qualify. You can also submit a screenshot from data from Strava, Garmin, and MapMyRun. If you run at least 10 miles per week or cycle at least 50 miles per week, you might qualify for a lower life insurance rate than you're currently paying. They're the only company that is invested in gathering science and data to prove that health-conscious people live longer.
They're the official life insurance partner of the RRCA, the Roadrunners Club of America, and also USA Triathlon, which is cool. So to see if you qualify and get a free rate quote today, visit healthiq.com/marathon. That's healthiq.com/marathon. And the final woman that we want to talk about is Paula Radcliffe.
Yes, Paula Radcliffe was born in England in 1973. She took up running at the age of 7 because she was influenced by her father, who was a marathoner. Despite suffering from asthma and anemia as a child, she ran cross-country while in school. At age 10, she accompanied her father to watch Ingrid Christensen run in the London Marathon, and that was what inspired her to really pursue a career in running and, you know, in athletics. She attended Loughborough University and got a degree in modern European studies while competing in track. Despite foot and ankle injury, she continued to do well at the 5,000-meter distance. So she didn't start out as a marathoner like many people. She made the move up to the marathon distance in 2002 and won the London Marathon. And she also set the current women's world marathon record at the 2003 London Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 15 minutes, and 25 seconds. And no one's been able to come close pretty much since that time.
Let me play a clip from Paula Radcliffe's world record-setting marathon win in 2003. She's only got a couple minutes left. I love how the commentators here at the London Marathon really put you in the moment and talk about just the significance of how far women's running had come and just how mind-blowingly fast Paula's time was.
Last year she came here, the athletic fans recognized her, This year she's come here as BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and everybody recognises her. It looks as though, to me, there are even bigger crowds out on the course today. And Paula is receiving tremendous support. She'll really appreciate this as she once again tries to rewrite the standards of women's distance running. I remember Abibi Bikila running 2 hours 15 minutes to win the gold medal in the Rome Olympics in 1960. And Paula Radcliffe is running almost the same time as the great man from Ethiopia did. And just look at the change. Just look at how much women's distance running has improved. And the great news for us is this improvement is being led. The record books are being rewritten by Britain's darling, Paula Radcliffe.
Into the mall, a huge reception for Paula Radcliffe. They came to see something special from the girl from Bedford, and she's produced it once more. It was a fantastic year last year. World Championships, European Championships, Commonwealth Games, gold medals on the track, a world record in the marathon in Chicago, but they wanted to see her do it in London, and she has produced the goods once more. Never mind nobody else in the world as quick as her in female athletics. There aren't many men can run faster than this. Paula Radcliffe storming home to win the 2003 London Marathon. Watch the time, watch the clock. She's going to smash the world record. Absolutely incredible. 2 hours, 15 minutes and around 25 seconds.
She also won the New York City Marathon in 2004 and the London Marathon in 2005. She has suffered from injuries over the years and took a break from running to rehab those injuries and to have her first baby. Then she returned to competition and won the New York City Marathon in 2007 and 2008. Then she was injured quite a bit after that, and she took 19 months off to heal and to have her second child. And her final professional marathon was in London in 2017. Throughout her career, she competed in the 3,000 meters to the marathon. Her personal best for the 5,000 meters was 14:29. She ran 30:01 in the 10,000 meters, 1 hour, 5 minutes, 40 seconds in the half marathon, and of course, 2 hours, 15 minutes, 25 seconds for the marathon world record, which has stood for 16 years. She represented Great Britain in the Olympics 4 times, and she's received numerous awards over the years. And she did retire after the 2017 London Marathon. She has been an outspoken voice against doping. She has written 2 books. She's a BBC commentator, and she currently resides with her family in Monte Carlo.
Not a bad way to retire.
I'll say.
So I think Paula Radcliffe's a good person to end with, because her story shows just how far women's marathon running has come in just a short time. When Abibi Bikila set the world record in 1960 at the Rome Marathon, the Olympic marathon, his time, like you told us, Angie, was 2 hours, 15 minutes, and 16 seconds. You know, did anybody back then think that a woman could ever run that fast? I mean, this is the fastest man on Earth in 1960. Fast forward 43 years later, Paula Radcliffe runs 2:15:25, basically doing what many people thought was impossible.
Right.
And, you know, keep in mind, folks, that Paula's marathon time has stood now for 16 years at the time of this recording. And when she ran it, it was only 10 minutes slower than the men's record at the time. So with all of her wins, she's been called the best female marathoner of all time and has really helped the world rethink what's possible for female runners. And I'm sure the impact that she's had on her country has been tremendous. There's a quote here from The Guardian. It says, quote, Hugh Brasher, the London Marathon's elite director, cites, quote, the Paula effect. He says, after her world record, you could hardly buy a pair of women's running shoes because most shops had sold out. Paula made something that was slightly eccentric for women to do entirely normal. And, you know, from what I've read as far as, like, what made her so great, it sounds like she has a really high pain tolerance. They were talking about one sports massage doctor who works on a lot of athletes said there's only one other person he ever had given a massage to who had a higher pain tolerance than Paula Radcliffe, and it was like some Irish rugby player. And also, interestingly, at the age of 17, she was found to have a VO2 max of 70, which was higher than any female athlete in the scientific literature at the time. And of course, when it came to her training, I also read she would run 140 to 150 miles a week.
Yes, typically she would run for 2 to 3 hours in the morning, and that would be followed by 2 hours of massage or physiotherapy. And then she would sleep for up to 2 hours before a late afternoon run, again followed by massage, strengthening exercises, and ice baths for recovery. So, you know, not only was running her full-time job, elite runners take recovery very seriously. You know, they often sleep an incredible amount, you know, get a lot of massages and physiotherapy done because it takes that much just to keep your body from breaking down. And, you know, obviously she struggled with a lot of injury through the years, which, you know, so she was basically just trying to reach her best without succumbing to injury.
And we'll end with a quote from Paula Radcliffe. She said, "Never set limits. Go after your dreams. Don't be afraid to push the boundaries and laugh a lot. It's good for you."
Great perspective. So as we're talking about the history of women in the marathon, since I was born in 1978, it's easy for me not to even think about the wide variety of running and racing and gear that's available to women nowadays. But just looking back on history, it's a good reminder for us not to take running, racing, and the opportunities that we have today for granted. It really just seems crazy that it wasn't until the 1970s that women were actually allowed to run in marathons. And although times have changed, thankfully, unfortunately, there are still people who have that mistaken notion that long-distance running is damaging to women. I remember a Facebook question that I got about 3 years ago from a listener whose mother was trying to dissuade her from running because she was afraid it would affect her uterus.
And she wanted grandkids, I guess, huh?
I guess so, yeah. So in some parts of the world, there are still mindset shifts taking place. You know, some places aren't advanced enough in women's freedom to allow women to run in public. So, you know, there are still ways that our world needs to move forward. So, you know, I guess one reflection for me is not to take things for granted because, you know, I'm just so thankful that I live in the day and age that I do. Things like women's specific running clothes, shoes, and sports bras weren't available until just over 40 years ago. For example, the first commercially available sports bra was called the Free Swing Tennis Bra that was introduced by Glamorize Foundations in 1975. And the first general exercise bra, initially called a jock bra, was invented in 1977. So that was close to the time when I was born. It was literally two jock straps sewn together.
No way.
Yeah, seriously. So these two women, Lisa Lindahl and her friend Polly Smith, were trying to come up with a supportive bra for runners. When, as a joke, Lisa's husband put a jock strap around his chest and said, "Here's your jock bra, ladies." And so they started fiddling with the design and came out with the first jog bra. Now, today, sports bras are a $7 billion industry worldwide. That's $7 billion. So
we need an MTA sports bra business, huh?
I don't know. I think the industry's covered. Even though running shoes or trainers have been around since the 1860s, the first women's sports shoes were not invented until the 1920s. And looking on them, they basically look like torture devices. It was basically like this stiff, strappy shoe with a heel on it. I mean, of all things.
A heel.
Yeah.
Like, so women need to wear high heels even when they run.
Well, so during the 1920s, women were first widely allowed to participate in sports. But the big dilemma was, would it detract from their femininity? Hence the heel. So it wasn't until 1976 that companies would begin to manufacture women's specific running shoes. So women who ran before then had to, you know, wear smaller men's sizes or maybe boys' sizes or like the women's nursing shoes with the soft leather. So yeah, it would be a lot more challenging to find comfortable shoes. And I think it's neat to see that a lot of these pioneers in the women's marathon have continued running. We just heard news that Catherine Switzer will be running the London Marathon for the first time this year. She's now age 71, and she's coming to run the London Marathon basically to celebrate the 100 years of when the UK allowed women to vote. So it's kind of a big year for women's rights in the UK, and they're celebrating 100 years of women being able to vote. So Catherine, of course, being a great pioneer for women, is going to run the marathon.
That's awesome. We hope you found inspiration from looking at the history of the marathon. Next time you're out there running, just think about all the great runners that have gone before you and what they've had to overcome. It might make your long run a little easier. Who knows? Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And Angie, I like to carry my phone when I run because I like to take pictures, partly because we have a blog and I always want good photos to go along with our race recaps, our world famous race recaps.
Of course.
Because I know all of our listeners always go over and read the blog and look at the pictures. Right, guys? Right? No, but I do like to carry my phone for music as well. So in the past, I've fumbled around. You couldn't imagine that, could you? Like me fumbling with stuff.
Shocking. All kinds of way to fumble. You don't want to fumble your phone, especially if you've paid several hundred dollars for it.
So we want to talk about some ways to carry your phone while you run.
Yeah, we actually got this question from Logan in our private Facebook group. And she says to her fellow runners, do you carry your phone when running? And if so, how do you carry it? She says she tried a flip belt and immediately started riding up and flopping around. She's seen the armbands, but they seem like they may be uncomfortable. I generally like running as a means to get away from my phone, but I get so far out with longer runs on a river trail and not near a phone that I kind of worry. So she sounds like me that, you know, her primary reason for carrying her phone is not because she's overly attached to it, but more for safety reasons.
Yeah, I hear what she's saying about armbands not being comfortable. I mean, some people might find them comfortable, but I remember that's the first thing I used was an armband. And it felt like after a while, it was cutting off circulation in that arm. Could have just been in my mind, but...
Plus, if you're running in the summer and, you know, you might get like a weird tan line from this big old armband.
Yeah, so here are some ways that your fellow runners have found to carry their phones while they run. Armbands being one of them.
That's right. And several people mentioned various waist packs, among them being the Nathan waist pack, the Spy Belt, the Amifod Micro Stretch Plus, another one called My Carbon Waist Pack, and one of Trevor's personal favorites, the Rue Sport. Some people mentioned that they have a water bottle sleeve that has a pocket big enough for a phone. And of course, then if you have a hydration pack, many of those have pockets. I have a nice Nathan hydration pack. So for long runs, I often will put my phone in the pocket there. And then there's many different running pants, shorts, and capris that have, you know, pockets for phones and devices. One of my favorites is from a company called Hylete. They have the Nimbus tights, which have a nice pocket along the side. And they also have some capris that I've worn during races and stashed my phone along the side. Lululemon pants, there's one with a side pocket that someone recommended. Also, 2XU have shorts with a pocket. There's Patagonia shorts with a pocket. And Wazelle pocket jogger capris. So there's some different options out there. If you thought only waist packs are the only thing available, then it might be a good idea to experiment with some of these recommendations.
I bought a waist belt at the Flying Pig Marathon in Cincinnati when I was there last year. And it's made by Fitletic. And it's like a single pouch. It's pretty good size. It can hold my phone and maybe like a UCAN bar. Yeah, stays in place, doesn't ride up. I've actually been using that lately and liking it. So it's Fitletic.
I think those only work for certain body types, though. A lot of women who have the smaller waist to hip ratio find that they bounce around a lot. So it's kind of important to
get experiment
and figure out what works for you. Lots of options.
I don't think it's waterproof either. Like, I haven't tested it, but that's another thing to consider is sometimes I will bring a little bag, like a Ziploc bag, in case it starts raining, and I'll put my phone in there because no one wants to be replacing your $700 phone, right?
Yes, I've done that too for races that have a chance of rain. I remember at the Mount Desert Island Marathon, it started to rain pretty heavily, so put my phone in the Ziploc bag and really didn't get many pictures.
So basically, at this juncture, I am either using the Fitletic waist belt or the Rue Sport.
And I am using the Hylete Nimbus running tights with the pocket down the side of the leg.
Any idea what they cost?
Well,
$200.
No, they're less than $100. They're not cheap, but they are amazing. Very high quality. I've used them for a lot of different workout scenarios. They're squat proof if you like to lift as well. So that's a plus.
Okay, and of course, we'll have links to everything that was mentioned. Also, some videos of some of the runners that we talked about over on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. We also have a contact form on our website if you want to send in a comment or question. We hope you enjoyed this two-part series about Heroes of the Marathon. Let us know what you think. Until next time, folks, train smart, run strong. Remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life.
Well on my way, well on my way. Bum 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 b